The 25th Annual Christian Prayer Breakfast for Fort Worth and Tarrant County was held at the Will Rogers Memorial Center on April 26, 2012. With a capacity crowd of over 1,800 people, this silver anniversary edition of the popular event was the largest ever. The featured speaker was retired U.S. Army Airborne Ranger, Major Jeff Strucker. Major Strucker served in the elite Ranger regiments of the Army for over 20 years and was a prominent figure in the Battle of Mogadishu in 1993, which was portrayed in the hit movie Black Hawk Down. Listen as Major Strucker is introduced and then tells part of his riveting story and the keystone part of his faith in God has played in his life.
It's my honor to introduce our speaker this morning. Jeff Strucker retired from the Army in January, a little over a year ago, after having served as a Ranger during the early part of his career. He entered the service at age 18, served for a number of years in the enlisted corps where the work gets done, shifted over to the officer corps, and re-entered service as a chaplain, serving Rangers mostly. In the military, those who become commissioned officers after having served in the enlisted ranks for a while are called Mustangs. We think that comes from the sort of little bit wild and unpredictable attitude that such officers have based on their knowledge and their identity with the enlisted ranks and their commitment to serve those who they're leading. Jeff Strucker was involved in every conflict that we know about from 1987 to the year till he retired in early 11. And some military actions that we probably are not aware of, such as the nature of serving with the elite Ranger Corps where they're deployed to do things that beat the public eye. On top of that, Jeff and his Ranger buddy competed for a grueling competition for top Ranger in the military, and this involves anyone who has graduated from the Ranger course and is able to qualify, including foreign allied forces and military services from the U.S. So it's quite a broad competition. And he and his Ranger buddy won that competition in 1996. It's remarkable. Jeff is best known for his heroic participation in the Battle of Mogadishu in 1993, which was chronicled in the book, which became a movie, Black Hawk Down. Jeff's sustained courage in the face of withering circumstances for several hours as he led an element of the rescue team was portrayed very accurately in that story. He tells me that that book and that movie just almost couldn't have been more representative of the actual events, even though there was a little bit of license taken to combine the actions of several characters into four main characters in the movie. It's amazing enough to contemplate that for several hours he led a rescue team on the ground to go into a cityscape combat situation, which is the toughest one, and to rescue American soldiers in trouble. They finally made it back to the U.S. compound safely, and it could stop there, and it's an amazing story, but it doesn't stop there. There was still work to be done, and Jeff and his team volunteered and went back out for yet another similar experience. That is incredible. So we're in the presence of greatness here. The question when we contemplate this type of activity sometimes is asked, where do we get such men? It's a rhetorical question, but it is useful because we all face challenges in our lives, and sometimes it gets scary. And the idea of how to meet scary situations with courage and confidence is potentially very, very instructive for all of us. You're going to like what you hear this morning. I promise that. And in your program, there is information as to how you can get more insight from Jeff Strucker's books. The title of one of his books is The Road to Unafraid. I'd recommend you get it and read it. Major Strucker, the troops are assembled. They've been through the chow line. They're sitting at ease, but we're all at attention for what you have for us this morning. And I confidently speak for everyone in the room that we thank you for your service to all of us. We are honored and humbled to be in the presence of one such as you. We offer you a warm welcome to Tarrant County and Fort Worth. Major Jeff Stricker.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks. I want to first start by saying what a great honor it is to be with you this morning. I know many of you got up very early to be here, and thank you so much for that. And we are going to respect your time and make sure that you're out of here by 8:30. I'll tell you that I have a chance to travel around the country, and I've been to a number of events like this around the country, but I have never been to something this size before. Yeah. They say that everything is bigger in Texas, and you know what? They're right about that this morning. And this didn't happen by accident. There's a lot of people that put a great deal of hard work into making this event possible. And if y'all don't mind, would you just give it up for all the folks that made this possible this morning? Now, what I'd like to do for the next few minutes is just describe for you a little bit about the experience that I went through in Mogadishu, Somalia, the stuff that was depicted in the movie Black Hawk Down. By the way, I just heard that if you were flipping through the channels surfing on television this morning, that Black Hawk Down was playing at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure that's not what you were expecting at 6 o'clock on a Thursday morning. I'd like to pull the curtain back a little bit and describe for you what was going on in my life and basically what was happening to me spiritually during those 18 hours, this big firefight in Mogadishu, Somalia, because that event was the most significant event for me spiritually in my lifetime. Now, as you just heard a second ago, I joined the Army as an 18-year-old. I grew up, I moved all over the place when I was young, but my family comes from Iowa, from Northwest Iowa. And in Iowa, if you don't own a farm or you're not somehow in the farming industry, the agricultural industry, there's not a whole lot of job opportunity for you. My family didn't own a farm. And when I was getting ready to graduate from high school, I had no idea what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I went to talk to an Army recruiter and I said, "What is the toughest job in the Army? I want to see if I have what it takes to meet with the best of the best." And there was a bit of discussion that day, but my recruiter said, "Jeff, without a doubt, hands down, the toughest job in the Army is to be an airborne ranger." I didn't know the first thing about the military, didn't have anybody giving me any advice per se. And so I said, "Well, whatever, sign me up for it. How do I go do that?" And he said, "Well, here's the deal. If you'll enlist, we'll send you to Fort Benning, Georgia, and we'll train you to be an infantryman. We'll send you to the Army's Airborne School, also at Fort Benning, Georgia." And my recruiter said, "Jeff, what will happen next is while you're in airborne school, some guys are going to come by and they're going to ask you to volunteer to serve as an airborne ranger. All you need to do is just simply raise your right hand. We'll take care of everything after that." And he was absolutely right. Before graduating from high school, I enlisted. As soon as I was done with high school, I was on my way to Fort Benning, Georgia. I was trained to be an infantryman. I attended the Army's Airborne School, and then I volunteered. And for the next 10 years consecutively, I served in the Ranger Regiment from private to the rank of platoon sergeant, sergeant first class, before I left to become a chaplain. Those 10 years are some of the most influential years of my life. And I am the man that I am today, largely because of the amazing warriors that I was surrounded by in the Army, in Special Operations, and in the Rangers. Now, before I joined the Army, though, before I became an airborne ranger, when I was 13 years old, my next-door neighbors came by to talk to me. I didn't know the first thing about faith. I didn't know the first thing about God, but my next-door neighbors sat down at my dining room table, and they explained to me what sin was. They talked to me about this guy, Jesus, that I'd heard about a lot. And they answered all the questions that I had. They were very patient with me. And then at the end of the conversation, they said, "Jeff, if you will turn your heart and your life over to Jesus Christ, he'll transform you. He'll make you into a new man." What they could not have known is that from my earliest memories, I don't know when this started, I had this absolutely overwhelming, terrifying fear of death. Man, I cannot tell you how many times I woke up in the middle of the night with this sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach, absolutely certain that I was going to die one day, that my heart would stop beating, and it terrified me about what happened next. I woke my family up in the middle of the night over and over again, and never could I find peace about my own death until my next door neighbors came by to talk to me. Because that night, I knelt by the side of my bed, I surrendered my life to Jesus Christ, and that night he radically changed me, and that night he dealt with that fear of death, and I never really worried about it after that. So this may sound a bit morbid to some of you in this room, but one of the reasons I wanted to become a ranger is first I wanted to see, do I have what it takes to serve with the best of the best? But secondly, I wanted to go to war. I wanted to be shot at, and I wanted to know, am I really over this fear of death? In December of 1989, I'd been in the Army for a couple of years. The United States was getting ready to invade the Republic of Panama in Operation Just Cause, and I was a sergeant in the Ranger Regiment. I got notified about the invasion a couple of days early. We were going to, on the night of the invasion, December 20th, we were going to put hundreds of airplanes in the sky that night, and Rangers from my unit were going to jump in and seize two airfields, and then the rest of the U.S. invasion force would follow on, and we expected that some of those airplanes might get shot down that night. So about 24 hours before the mission began in Panama, I arrived in the country on an Air Force airplane in secrecy and provided a search and rescue force for the night of the invasion. Now, for the next couple of weeks in Panama, I was doing what all the rest of the U.S. forces were doing there. We were trying to defeat the Panamanian defense forces. And ultimately, we were trying to capture the leader of the country, Manuel Noriega, and bring him back to the United States to stand trial. Now, I was in situations in the invasion of Panama when I was being shot at, but I never really thought that it was life or death, that I'm not going to survive the next few moments. So when the mission was over with and when I got back to my base, I remember thinking, you know, before I left for this invasion, I had a lot of loose ends that were untied and a lot of things that I had not said or done that I probably should have. I would have had regrets if something happened to me. And the number one thing on my list of regrets, if I never made it back out of the invasion of Panama alive, was that my high school sweetheart, I was head over heels in love with her, but I didn't have the courage to ask her to marry me. So the first chance that I got after returning from Panama, I tell people that Panama scared this into me. I went out and bought a ring and flew back to our hometown, and I proposed, and my wife, Dawn, and I set a date to get married about a year later. Now, if you're a history buff out there, you know that a year later, the U.S. was involved in Operations Desert Shield and Desert Storm. I was about 6 or 8 weeks away from our wedding day. Dawn had taken care of almost all of the details. She was just about ready to send out the invitations when I had to get on the phone. And because I was in special operations, the conversation went something like this. I said, Dawn, I can't tell you when I'm leaving. I'm not authorized to tell you where I'm going. And I don't know when I'm going to get back. But I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be in the country on our wedding day. And after a long pause on the phone, she could read between the lines. And she said, Jeff, if this is true, you need to fly back home and we need to get married right away. Basically, she was saying, I'll give up the big white church wedding for a little small ceremony in our home church, just to have a chance to get married before you go off to war again. Now, I was a tough Army Ranger with combat experience, so I did what any of you guys in this room would do in that circumstance. I said, yes, ma'am, and I got on a plane and I flew back to our hometown. This is not an exaggeration. I got caught in an ice storm, and 2 hours after landing in our hometown, I was getting married in a little church ceremony. And then on my way back to Georgia and ultimately to Kuwait as part of Operation Desert Storm. Now, I was getting shot at there too, but it was nothing like I experienced in Mogadishu, Somalia. Most of you in this room are probably familiar with the book or the movie Black Hawk Down. I won't rehash all of those details for you, but I will tell you a little bit about my role there. I was in 3rd Ranger Battalion when we got notified that things were going south in Mogadishu, Somalia. This little country on the Horn of Africa in the early 1990s had hundreds of thousands of people dead as a result of famine and starvation. You all will remember probably the images of the Marines landing on the beaches and providing food to the starving people of Somalia. And that country then, and by the way, it is very much the same circumstances today, had no functional government, no military, no police force, and no one stopping armed, lawless men from doing whatever they wanted. The capital city, Mogadishu, was controlled by about 7 warlords. They're like gang leaders, and they controlled little pockets of the city. And they were fighting against each other, trying to become the most powerful man in the country. Now, most of those warlords didn't mind the United States being there, but one of them did, Mohammed Farah Aidid. And Aidid made the decision to start to target United Nations and United States forces while they were handing out food in the capital of Mogadishu. In June of 1993, Aidid and his men ambushed and murdered 24 Pakistani United Nations workers while they were handing out food to his own people. And the United Nations Security Council met together and said, something must be done about Aidid. This man must be brought to justice for what he's doing in Somalia. And the U.S. military responded with Task Force Ranger. That was my unit, a company of Rangers from Fort Benning, Georgia. It was a helicopter unit from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and some special operators from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We met together with just a couple of days' notice, and we went to Mogadishu with a very different mission than the rest of the United Nations forces there. Our mission was to find Aidid and the high-ranking leaders of his organization and take them all out, capture them if possible, but take them out and bring them to justice for the death of these Pakistani workers. We were systematically working our way through Aidid's clan, taking down some of the highest leadership in the clan. But this mission was taking a lot longer than we expected. And we were getting a lot of pressure from Washington, D.C. to wrap this thing up and to go home. Now, I was a 24-year-old squad leader by then. I had 10 men that I was responsible for. And my job was to lead the Humvees back and forth through the city streets on every mission that Task Force Ranger did in Somalia. We got this tip on Sunday afternoon, October 3rd, that two of the very high-ranking leaders of Aidid's clan were meeting in the same building at the same time. Now, Rangers don't like to go do operations during the daytime. We prefer to do it at night. And this was the very center of the Aidid part of the city, and this was the most dangerous of all circumstances. We all knew that ahead of time. But this was too important of an opportunity to let pass by. So we launched a mission to go get these two guys. Special operators loaded on Little Bird helicopters. They flew inside the building and they assaulted into the target and they started to take down the building and take care of business inside. As all of that was going on, Rangers flew in on Black Hawk helicopters and slid down ropes. We call it fast rope. To the four corners of the target building. And their mission was to keep all the bad guys inside while those special operators were doing their thing in there. And while that was happening, I led this long column of Humvees through the city streets. We placed Humvees at each of the four corners of the target building. And my mission was to keep everyone else in the capital city out of that building until those special operators were done. When they were done, we'd grab all the bad guys and put them on our Humvees. And then the rest of the assault force would jump on our Humvees, and we would drive them all back to our base. It was only supposed to take about 30 minutes. And actually, for the first 30 minutes, this thing went almost exactly like we thought it was going to go, with one exception. When those Black Hawks were flying in that day and when Rangers were sliding down the ropes, we don't know what happened, but one of the Rangers named Todd Blackburn missed the rope, and he fell about 70 feet, and he landed in the city streets head first. When I got to the target building in my Humvees, my commander was already calling me on the radio saying, Jeff, we've got a seriously wounded Ranger. I need to put him on your vehicles and take him back to the base immediately. He may not survive the next few minutes. I ran up to get to Blackburn. He was unconscious, bleeding from his nose and his mouth. And he had a medic working on him just trying to keep him alive. So I placed him on a Humvee with no protection around him. Put myself and half of my guys on a Humvee in front of him and all the rest of my men on a Humvee behind him just to provide some guns to get him out of the city and to try to keep him alive. Now, we were being shot at already, and this is in the first few minutes of this mission. We were being shot at already from a number of directions, but it wasn't really effective, wasn't really accurate gunfire, and I really wasn't worried about the gunfire as much as I was the city streets. You see, in Mogadishu, those roads were really, really in bad condition, and I didn't want that Humvee behind me to hit some bumps and further injure Todd Blackburn's neck or his head. So I instructed my driver to drive very slowly, maybe 10 or 15 miles an hour, as we headed back to our base. We drove down this narrow alleyway, and then I made a right turn onto one of the only major roads. And folks, when I turned the corner onto this road, it seemed like the entire city erupted with gunfire on these three Humvees. We were being shot at from every direction imaginable down narrow streets that were 20 feet wide, from 100 directions at the same time, rooftops and alleyways and doorways and windows. There were rocket-propelled grenades and automatic gunfire and guys throwing hand grenades at us. And I had a guy on the top of my Humvee with a 50-caliber machine gun. He was holding the trigger down and spraying bullets in every direction, just hoping to hit somebody as we drove down the road, but he wasn't being very effective that way. So I told him to take his machine gun and face it to the left and shoot at all the enemy fighters to the left. Another guy was sitting right behind me. To this day, he is the best machine gunner I've ever seen in my life, named Dominic Pilla. And I told Pilla to take his machine gun, face it to the right, and shoot at all the enemy fighters to the right. Another guy in the back seat would shoot at all the bad guys to the rear. I'd shoot at all those bad guys in front of us, and together we would kill as many of them as possible, just trying to keep ourselves alive long enough to make it back to our base. What I didn't know is on the right side of the road, down the street waiting for us, was a Somali gunman. And when we got right next to him, he saw Dominic Pilla at the same time that Pilla saw him. These two guys turned their weapons to each other at the same moment, and they shot and killed each other at the exact same instant. Pilla was hit in the forehead just above his right eye. He sustained a massive head wound, and he was killed instantly. And he fell over into the lap of Specialist Tim Moynihan. And then Moynihan began to lose control and panic. He was screaming my name, "Sergeant Strucker, Pilla's been hit. He's been killed." And when I looked over my shoulder, it looked like the whole backside of that Humvee had just been painted red with Dominic Pilla's blood. And for the first time since I was a 13-year-old boy, I started to panic, thinking, I'm going to die in the next few seconds. And then my training kicked in, and the very next thing that came to my mind is that I am a leader, and I'm in charge here, and I need to get myself under control if I'm going to be able to get my men under control. So very calmly, very deliberately, I told Moynihan to take his weapon, face it to the right side of the vehicle, pick up Dominic Pilla's sector of fire, and engage as many of these bad guys as possible if we have any chance of surviving the next few moments. Now, I went through a number of other obstacles and difficulties. I don't have time to tell you about all of them right now, but when I finally made it back to our base, it was total chaos back there. People were running in every direction. The medic was rushing to my Humvee to pull Dominic Pilla's dead body off of the back, and the surgeon was running to get to Todd Blackburn to try to keep him alive. And I was completely exhausted, leaning over the hood of that Humvee, thinking, God, I can't believe that I survived that. I can't believe that any of us are still alive right now. And about that moment, my platoon leader, Lieutenant Larry Moores, walked up to me. He said, "Hey, Jeff, a Black Hawk helicopter just got shot down. Mike Durant is crashed in the city, and we don't have anybody else who can go out there to see if there's any survivors. I need you to get your men back on your Humvees and go see if there's anybody alive at the Durant crash site." As he was walking away, one of the special operators who came back with me overheard this conversation. And he said, "Hey, Sergeant, if you're going back out into those city streets tonight, don't leave your men in the back of that Humvee sitting in all of that blood." He said, "That will have serious psychological effects on them for the rest of their life if you do that. You probably need to go clean this Humvee up." So I sent all the rest of my guys to get some more fuel, to get some more ammunition. And I pulled this Humvee off to the side. With no running water, I took buckets and brushes and sponges, and I started to clean off Dominic Pilla's blood as I was getting ready to go back out in the city streets to the Mike Durant crash site. And folks, I can easily tell you that I have never been so terrified in my life as I was standing at the back of that Humvee that day. Everything inside of me was saying, no, Jeff, don't do this. This is crazy. It's suicide to go back out there. I was thinking, as a leader, Jeff, not only are you going to get killed, but you're going to get every one of your men killed in the next few minutes. There'll be 10 more body bags tomorrow morning if you drive back through that. And to make matters worse, Dawn and I had been married for a couple of years at this point. We'd been trying the whole time to have a child. And I got a letter in the mail just a few weeks before this saying that she was pregnant with our first child. And I was thinking, I'm never going to see my wife again. And my child is going to grow up and never know who their daddy is. And everything was saying, don't do this. But folks, here's the deal. Special operators and rangers are a unique group of men who have sworn their life to live by a creed. And one of the things that the Ranger Creed says is that I will never leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of the enemy. And no matter how bad I didn't want to do it, I knew I didn't have a choice. I was going to have to turn around and to go back out there, and it terrified me. So I was cleaning the back of that Humvee off, getting ready to go back out into those city streets, thinking, God, I don't want to do this because I know I'm going to die in the next few minutes if I do. And as I was cleaning up the back of that Humvee, I started to pray. Now, I didn't beg and plead or negotiate with God or anything like that. I just said, God, I'm in big trouble right now, and I need your help. As I was standing by the back of that Humvee, everything that I said I believed about this guy, Jesus, became absolutely important, totally real to me. You see, I said I believe that Jesus is in control of my life, that my life is not in my hands, it's in his hands, and I realized there's nothing I can do next to preserve it. I'm going to have to trust him with it no matter what happens next. But then I realized this, and I should have known this all along, but it didn't make sense to me to the back of this Humvee. I realized one of two things is going to happen next. If by some miracle of God, if I survive this mission, I'll be able to go home to my wife and to our growing family in Fort Benning, Georgia. But if it's God's plan that I die on the streets of Mogadishu, Somalia, before my body hits the ground, my soul will go immediately to the presence of my Father in heaven. And I realize that either I go home to my family in Georgia or I go home to my Father in heaven. In either case, I cannot lose no matter what happens next. And folks, that gave me all the courage that I needed for the rest of the night. From that moment on, I realized because of my faith in Jesus Christ, because of what this man Jesus did for me 2,000 years ago when he went to the cross and dealt with my sins, but more importantly, because 3 days later he came back up out of the tomb, I don't have to worry about death, even though it may be in the next few seconds, because my King has already conquered the grave. He's already conquered death. And I cannot lose, no matter what happens to me next. Thank you. That and that alone gave me the confidence to get back on those Humvees and to drive back out into those city streets. We didn't have the technology then that we have today. So my boss said, Jeff, that helicopter crashed somewhere in here on the map. But he said, if you'll turn your radio to this frequency, we've got a helicopter flying in the air. He'll tell you where to go. He'll tell you where to turn. He'll take you straight to the crash site. Now, all of the guys that were shooters from our unit were already in the city streets. And when it gets this bad, everybody becomes an infantryman in combat. And we asked all of the rest of the guys from our task force if they were able to jump on those Humvees and to go back out there and to provide some more guns and to see if anybody was alive at the Durant crash site. I had an intelligence analyst who took Pilla's place in the back of my Humvee. And I had a cook that got on the vehicles and a supply clerk and an ammunition specialist. Man, it was like the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, but they all jumped in their vehicles with those guns. And they were getting ready to roll back out into the city streets with me when one of my men walked up to me and he said the most difficult words that a ranger will ever say to another ranger in combat. He looked me right in the eyes and he said, Sergeant, I can't do this. I can't go back out there. because I know I'm going to die in the next few minutes if I go back out there. I'm married, I've got a family at home, and I can't go back out there into those city streets with you. I said, listen, man, I know that you're scared. I am too. All of us are. In fact, you're a lunatic if you're not afraid at this point. But I said, I don't want you to think about yourself as a coward simply because you're afraid. And I said, you know the difference between a real hero and a coward? It's not fear. It's what you do when you are afraid that makes a difference. And I said, I won't make you go back out there, but I need you on those Humvees. And the guys that are still in those city streets, they need you. And I turned around and I walked away. And I watched this guy in my rearview mirror reach down, pick up his weapon, get on the back of that Humvee and drive back out in those city streets with me, fully expecting to die in the next few moments. And I have never been so proud of a soldier in all of my life as I was that guy that moment. The helicopter said, Jeff, drive down this road, take a left turn at this corner, and you'll see some tires burning in front of you. Take a turn, turn right at the burning tires, and you'll go straight to the Durant crash site. What that helicopter didn't know is that right before those burning tires, there were several Somali gunmen waiting for me, right on the side of the road in ambush. When I got right next to them, with this long column of cooks and clerks behind me, one of them opened up on my vehicle with a rocket-propelled grenade. It bounced off of the hood of my Humvee and exploded into the wall next to me. And then several of them from 10 feet away opened up with automatic gunfire and riddled this Humvee with bullet holes from bumper to bumper. And I can't explain why, except God's miraculous hand was on us, because not one dude in my Humvee was hit in that exchange of gunfire. And I backed out of there and called this helicopter and said, man, this is way too intense. I can't drive cooks and clerks through all of that. You need to find us another route to the crash site. And as we were driving around the city, I linked up with a whole bunch of other Rangers from my unit who were on vehicles that were completely destroyed and dead bodies were hanging off of the sides. So we stopped our convoy. I loaded all of these people up. In one case, I had to destroy a Humvee in the city streets by placing a thermite grenade on the engine block. And I drove all these guys back to our base. Now, this is my second time back, and I thought we had everybody accounted for. And my boss said, no, Jeff, half of the assault force is still out there. And we need to go back out there and get them, but there's no way we can keep going out there in Humvees. We're losing more men than we're saving by going out there like that. So we asked the United Nations for help. The Pakistanis came with two of their tanks. The Malaysians came with their armored personnel carriers, and other U.S. forces met us at our base. And at about 11 o'clock that night, I rolled back out into the city streets in my same Humvees. Spent until 9 o'clock the next morning fighting back and forth with the Somalis and losing men all night long until the rest of our men could be loaded up and taken back to our base. Now, folks, as intense as the events of that firefight was, I was not prepared for what I saw the next morning. You see, what I saw the next morning when I pulled back into our base was total chaos. Man, I have been trying for years while I was a sergeant with the Rangers to share my faith in Jesus with Rangers, but most of them didn't want to hear it. They would say stuff like this: hey, Jeff, that Jesus stuff, that's fine for you. You can have him, but I don't need him. Because I'm strong, I'm fast, I'm smart, and I've got where I'm at all on my own, and I don't need you, Jeff, and I don't need your Jesus. Well, the day after this big firefight was over with, these same guys were walking up to me with tears in their eyes. And they were saying, Jeff, what happened to my best friend who just got killed last night? What happens to me if I get on a helicopter or a Humvee and I don't make it? And then most of them were saying, Jeff, there's something different about you than there was me last night. I could hear it in your voice over the radio. You have something that I don't have, and I want to know what it is. And for the next 24 hours, I had men lined up waiting to talk to me because they could see that Jesus is real when the chips were down and when the bullets were flying. They could tell that he was real by the way that I was living my life. And I can take you to the exact spot in Mogadishu, Somalia, where God started to show me that he had something different in store for me than kicking in doors and slinging lead with the enemies of our country when he was calling me into the ministry. As you just heard, I spent the last 10 years as an active duty Army chaplain before retiring, most of those 10 years with the same Rangers that I was with in Somalia. I deployed 9 times to Afghanistan and 5 to Iraq over those 10 years. And I can tell you, I saw men do feats on the battlefield that are unprecedented. We have literally warriors in our country that no one else on planet Earth has. And I stood in awe of what those men were willing to do for our country and for our freedom in Iraq and Afghanistan. One of my friends, by the way, a Navy chaplain who I was working with in Afghanistan, is in this room today. And Guy, if you don't mind, would you stand up so that everybody can recognize you? I saw soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines do things on the battlefield in Iraq and Afghanistan that are absolutely stunning and amazing. And God gave me opportunities that many others didn't have, because I could look warriors in the eyes and I could say, I know exactly what you're going through because I've been there myself. And let me tell you who got me through it when life was difficult and when the chips were down. And most of those guys were saying, Jeff, I don't even know if this Jesus stuff is real. I'm not sure that I believe in Jesus. And I was like, that's all right. Man, just listen. We'll talk about it. We'll pray about it. Let's study some scripture together and let's see whether or not Jesus is real. But I hope that you'll see that he's real to me. And my guess is, when life gets real tough, if I have the chance to be next to you, you'll see that he's real in some of the most difficult circumstances of life. Now, let me tell you why so many people have put so much effort into making this morning possible. Let me tell you why you have this little DVD on the table in front of you that says, the CD that says The Search for Answers. Because there are probably many of you in this room who are asking the question, is this thing called Christianity legitimate? Is Jesus real? And I want to tell you that if you've never heard it before, I can tell you from personal experience that in the most tragic and difficult circumstances of your life, if you will turn it all over to him, if you'll place faith in Jesus Christ, he will get you through whatever you're facing. If you're going through a health crisis right now, I mean, if you've been in a doctor's office and the test results have come back and he's saying it's not good, Jesus is real and he's ready to help you get through it. If you're going through a family crisis, if you've got a husband or a wife of 30 years who sat across the table and said, look, there's somebody else and I'm out of here, and you don't know where to turn to next, the Bible says you have a friend that sticks closer than a brother and he'll never leave you. He'll never bail on you. Or maybe you're in a financial crisis. Maybe you've been hanging on with your fingernails for the last few years during this difficult economy. And things are not getting better. They're only getting worse. And you're thinking, man, I don't know how we're going to make payroll. We may lose the business, or I may lose the house, and you don't know where to turn to next. Well, if that's the circumstances that you're in right now, I want you to know that you have a God who loves you, who will be right there with you. And though he may not get you out of the difficulties that you're going through, he'll get you through them if you totally and completely turn it over to him. I am a living example of that. And so my challenge for you today is this, while I wrap up. It is that if you've never done it before, you'll consider putting it all in his hands, trusting your life and your eternity to Jesus Christ. Because I guarantee you, if you'll sincerely turn it over to him, he won't fail you. He won't bail on you. He'll be there with you every second of every day. And by the way, when you face life's greatest fear, the fear of death, because this is the test that nobody cheats on, the Bible says that death is just a door that you walk through. And Jesus is waiting for you on the other side. And so my challenge for you today is that you would turn it all over to him if you've never done it before. And if you've done it and you know Jesus is real, that when you walk out the doors of this building, you'll live like it. And people will see that he's real in your life. So if you don't mind, I'm going to wrap up with a quick prayer. And then we're going to close our program so that you can get on with the rest of your day. But why don't you bow your head so that we can pray together? Our God in heaven, it is no coincidence that the people that are in this room, you brought them there, brought them here today for a purpose. And Jesus, I pray that right now, for some people in this room who are saying, I don't know if I believe in Christianity. I don't know if I even believe in Jesus. I'm not sure that he makes a difference. I pray that right now you would show the people in this room that you're real, that you love them so much that you went to the cross to pay for the issue that separated them from you. You paid for their sins. And everything has been done necessary so that they can have an intimate relationship with you. God, would you cause people in their seats right now to turn their heart and lives over to you? That they would say something like this: God, I admit it. I'm a sinner, and I don't deserve to go to heaven. But I believe you sent your son Jesus, who paid the price for my sins and died a brutal death for me. And then 3 days later, he rose again so that I can have the promise of eternal life. And I'm not sure what all of this means, but right now, today, the best that I know how, I'm turning it over to you. I'm putting it all in your hands. Anywhere you want me to go, I'll go. Anything you want me to do, I'll do it. Jesus, you are my king. You're calling the shots in my life from now on. And God, I know if that prayer is sincere, if it's real, you'll hear it and you'll transform hearts. Maybe there's some people in this room like the prodigal who've turned around and walked away from you for a long time. And today, God, I ask you to draw them back to yourselves and show them nothing is worth more than an intimate walk with you, an intimate relationship with you, their creator. And finally, God, I pray for the people in this room who are believers, who know Jesus Christ personally, that when they walk out the doors of this room, they would be able to say, I will face my life without fear. And I want my neighbors, my coworkers, the people I go to school with, to see that Jesus is real in the way that I live my life. God, would you please do something right now that only you can get the credit for? Would you touch hearts? Would you transform lives? I pray this for Jesus' sake and in his name. Amen. Folks, you have seen this little card on your table. I hope at this point that you filled it out. You'll see some little blocks down there, the little lines that you can let us know if you've responded this morning to what you've just heard. And I want to tell you again what a great honor it is to be with you. You are a very patriotic community, and I am glad just to be able to stand among your midst. I hope that you have a great day today. God bless you.